Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Yud Tet Amud Aleph, three lines down. Gemara says, Amamar, this is going back to the Braita that we quoted earlier, Vabanim Natlu B'Zchut Avi Avihen U'B'Zchut Avi Imonotehem. So here it says, with regards to the Meraglim, and with regards to the Mitlonunim and Atat Korach, that those individuals did not inherit from their parents, because their parents were killed for whatever reason that we enumerated over there in the Midbar, and they were not entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, their only right to get a portion in Eretz Yisrael came through their grandfather. That is, whether it's through their paternal grandfather or their maternal grandfather. V'hatanyo, don't we have a b'raita b'zchut atzman, that they got it on their own virtue, that they got it? Mar says, lo kasho, that's not a problem. Hankamanda amar l'yotzei Mitzrayim, hankamanda amar l'bayi aretz. Depends which position you're taking. Are you taking the position that it belonged to those that left Mitzrayim? Or are you taking it from the position that it belonged to those that entered into the land? Sagaman de Mal Yotzei Mitzrayim, that's according to Rabbi Yeshaya, who says it was distributed to the Yotzei Mitzrayim. And in that case, they would not be entitled to property through their parents, because their parents had passed away for these problematic reasons, whether they were Miraglim, Mitlonanim, or Adat Korach. And therefore, they didn't get any entitlement of property through their parents, because their parents were knocked out of the picture when they died in the Midbar for their sins. On the other hand, they still have an entitlement through their grandparents to that Yerusha, because even though their parents were knocked out, it still passes Yerusha to these children. And therefore, through their grandparents, whether it's their paternal grandfather, where they have a direct right to the inheritance, or whether it's their maternal grandfather, where they have a right, if their mother is the sole heir to their grandfather's property, that is the way that they would come into possession of property. On the other hand, the one that says that they got it b'zchut atzman, that's speaking according to the one that says it was distributed to the Bayei Aretz, to those that entered into the land of Israel, and therefore they got entitlement because as when they were over 20, when they entered the land of Israel, that's when they got the land, and they got it because of their own zchut, because of their entering into the land, nothing to do with their parents. And that's why it says the Braita b'zchut atzman, that they inherited it. So now, here, as the Rashbam points out, even though the ratio of that Braita can only be explained, like we did back then, speaking about Yotzei Mitzrayim, because there it says that the Meraglim's portion was given to Yoshua v'Kalev. So Yoshua and Kalev, if they took the portion of the Meraglim, the only way the Meraglim would have had a portion in Eretz Yisrael is if it was given out to the Yotzei Mitzrayim. We offered there two possibilities as to who the author of that Braita was. One possibility was it was Rav Yoshaya, who also says that it's distributed to Yotzei Mitzrayim. Or the other possibility was Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, who says it was both distributed to the Yotzei Mitzrayim, as well as to the Bayei Aretz. So the Rashbam over here favors heavily saying that it is that opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, who says that there's a portion that's given because you are Yotzei Mitzrayim, and there's another portion given as Bayei Aretz. So now, in this situation, when you say B'zchut Atzman, that they get it because of their own merit, that is, because it was awarded to the Bayei Aretz. It was awarded to those that were entering into the land of Israel. So these individuals who are entering into the land of Israel, they will get a portion, not because their father gave it to them, nothing to do with whether their father sinned or not sinned, because of their own merit, meaning that they're old enough in terms of their ability to enter into the land and take a portion in the land. So therefore, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, the individuals here, they had a right to the land of Israel in and of themselves, plus they got an additional portion from their fathers or their previous generation that were from Yotzei Mitzrayim. When they passed away, they also inherited their portion in the land. So they got a quote-unquote double portion in the land, a portion for themselves, because they were over the age of 20 going into Eretz Yisrael. But they also were entitled to a portion from their fathers who had been Yotzei Mitzrayim and passed away in the Midbar. So those individuals who were the children of the Meraglim, the Mitlonanim, and the Adat Korach, they lost out on that additional portion, because they're not going to inherit anything from their father. They're only going to inherit the piece of land that they're entitled to as Bayei Aretz. And so therefore, when we say that Lam is according to the one who says that the Bayei Aretz, that's a reference to Mishim ben Elazar. Because according to Rabbi Yonatan, who says that it was only distributed to the Bayei Aretz, there is no nafkamina, the fact that they were the children of Meraglim or not the children of Meraglim, they're going to inherit because of their own rights, irrespective of whether they are children of Meraglim or not children of Meraglim. There's no chiddush in that. On the other hand, there are those who want to suggest that even according to Rabbi Yonatan, who says that the Bayei Aretz Nitchalka Aretz, that's what the Gemara means over here, literally according to Rabbi Yonatan's opinion, And there is a nafkamina between them, because even Rabbi Yonatan, who says it was nechalkal baye aretz, there's still a din of chazarah. There's still a din of returning it back to the Yotzei Mitzrayim and then redividing up the property. So what the suggestion would be is that there's a difference between the Bnei Meraglim versus other parties. Other parties would return it to the Yotzei Mitzrayim and then it would be redistributed to the baye aretz. On the other hand, those that are Mibaye aretz, whose parents were amongst the Meraglim, the Mitlonanim, or that Korach, there would be no chazarah. It would not return through their parents, because their parents were precluded from getting any nachala, and they were not included in that requirement of chazarah. So those individuals will keep the property that they were ba'el aretz, entitled to as ba'el aretz, and not have this din of chazarah. So that's the way to explain it according to Rabbi Yonatan, although you can see that the Rashbam favors heavily saying that it is authored by Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar for a number of reasons, including the Reisha and the Seifa fit in much better according to him. And therefore, when it says Mibaye Aretz, means in addition to being Yotzei Mitzrayim, they're also entitled as Baye Aretz. The difference between the Bnei Meraglim, Adad Korach, Mitlonanim, and others was, what, did they get one portion in the land? Because they only got it because they were Baye Aretz, but not because of Yotzei Mitzrayim, because their parents lost that right. Or are they entitled to not only as Baye Aretz, but also as Yotzei Mitzrayim, because of the fact that they were not children of people who were problematic, and therefore they got two portions in the land. And that's what it means, that it was Mibaye Aretz, that they got something B'schut Atzman. Mibaye Daiman, some say, Ha, V'ha, the Baye Aretz. That if both of them were a case of Baye Aretz, the way that Rashbam explains it over here, it's according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. It's not according to Rabbi Yonatan, but rather according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who says that the Yotzei Mitzrayim and the Baye Aretz were entitled to property. Then you can make the distinction in the following manner, whether they were over the age of 20 or under the age of 20. If they are over the age of 20, then they get, because of Zchut Atzman, they have a right to collect property. If they are under the age of 20, then they don't have a right in and of themselves to collect property as Baye Aretz, but they still have a right because of their inheritance of that which came from the Yotzei Mitzrayim. That only makes sense according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who says that there is both entitlement to the Yotzei Mitzrayim and the Baye Aretz. And because of that, you can get Yerusha in one of two ways. You can get it because you yourself are old enough when you enter in the land of Israel, or you can get it because of your entitlement through your grandparents. So you could explain, even if it's not according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, and it's according to Rabbi Yonatan, who says literally that it only went to the Baye Aretz, you could explain the whole sugya here because of Chazara. Even Rabbi Yonatan agrees that the Baye Aretz, who got the land, then passed it back to the Yotzei Mitzrayim, and it was redistributed along the lines of the Yotzei Mitzrayim. So even where Rabbi Yonatan, there is a nafkamina between whether you are a child of one of these problematic individuals versus if you're just a regular child. Because if you're over the age of 20, of course, you get from your own rights, because you're an enterer into the land, you're entitled to property. But even according to Rabbi Yonatan, who says that if you're below the age of 20, you do not get land, you still have rights to land because of Chazarah, that which was passed back to the generations before. So if you have first cousins who inherited land, then when they pass it back to your great-grandfather, you will be entitled to that property when it gets redistributed amongst those descendants of the patriarch of the family that it's passed back to, who was a part of the Yotzei Mitzrayim. But then the Rashbam goes on to prove from there that it has to be that we're speaking about a great-grandchild and a great-grandparent, because otherwise the years don't work out, then you can have a possibility of somebody being under the age of 20. If you were speaking about the children of Adad Korach, or the Mitlonanim, which they associate with Adad Korach, the 250 individuals, as well as the Meraglim, we know for certain that the Meraglim take place in the second year in the Midbar, because that is dated in the Chumash. Adad Korach in the Chumash does not have any date associated with it, and therefore it's a machloket in the Rishonim as to when it actually took place. First of all, there's the Ibn Ezra, who has an opinion that even possibly took place before the Meraglim. Others suggest that based on the order in the Chumash, it took place after the Meraglim. But even if you say it's after the Meraglim, it doesn't have a date associated with it. In Seder Olam Rabbo, it suggests that it is in the second year of the sojourn in the Midbar. And that means that anybody who was a part of any of these problematic scenarios, if they had children, the minimum age of their children when they entered into Eretz Yisrael was 38. For that reason, as the Rashbam points out and the other Rishonim point out, there's no way that you can explain this as referencing to the children of the Meraglim, the children of Mitlonanim, or the children of Adad Korach. Because if you believe that it took place early in the Midbar, then their children for sure are over the age of 20. So then how can the Gemara give an answer that they were under the age of 20 or over the age of 20? Based on that, the Rashbam comes to the conclusion that we're not speaking about the children of those individuals, but rather the grandchildren of those individuals. And when we speak about Avihem or Avimotehem, we don't mean their grandparents, we actually mean their great-grandparents. And that's how they solve the problem with regards to this under 20. You have now a way to solve the problem. That what's Bezchut Atzman? Bezchut Atzman is if these grandchildren were over the age of 20, then they would have the ability to take a portion of the land of Eretz Yisrael for themselves because they were over the age of 20 and they'd be counted amongst those that received it. If they are under the age of 20, what's known as Tefillim, then they would not receive it when they go into the land of Israel. But then they would be able to garner a portion of the land. Not because of their parents necessarily, not because of their grandparents, but because of their great-grandparents, which means that they have individuals, cousins, who are related, and then you are machzir, that which came from their cousins, back up to those previous generations, and then it's redistributed to them. But according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, who says that there is no chazara, then what it means literally is that it comes straight or directly from their great-grandfather, or great-grandfather where from the paternal side, if there is somehow they inherited land, as you'd say, Mitzrayim, then it would pass down to them. So even though the Mitzlonanim or Dat Korach or the Meraglim lost their own portion of the land, meaning that when they were Yotzei Mitzrayim and they were entitled to a portion of land, they lost that portion. Nevertheless, their parents still had portions in the land if they were Yotzei Mitzrayim, if they were over the age of 20 when they were Yotzei Mitzrayim. And that was passed down through the generations till it reached the individuals entering into the land of Israel. So even though they may not have been of age 20 and they didn't get anything because of their own age or on their own, they still would have received it from their great-grandparents. And so that's how to answer the question of the Stira and the Breitot as to whether they got it from their own sechut, from their own merit, or they got it because of the merit of their grandparents. And again, the Rashbam points out it's not literally their grandparents, but rather their great-grandparents. All right, so now the Gemara continues. V'shaya b'chor notel shnei chalakim. We learned that the Bechor took two portions. Va'amai. Why does a Bechor get two portions in the land? Ra'uihu. Ve'en a Bechor notel b'ra'ui k'muchzak. Bechor gets a double portion, but there is a limitation to what the Bechor gets. Bechor only gets a double portion in what is muchzak. That which is in the possession of the individual bequeathing the Yerusha. So over here it's the father that is bequeathing the Yerusha to his children. The children at the time of that distribution, anything that's in the possession of the father, you get a double portion in. Anything that is ra'oi, that will only come in the future, that you do not get a double portion in. So over here, when we're talking about the Benot Tzlafchad, they claim that their father Tzlafchad is entitled to a double portion in his father Chefer's property because he was the Bechor. And that means that when Chefer passes away, then the property will then pass to his son. And they would inherit in place of the son as a Bechor. But we say that's only true for property that's in the possession of Chefer when he passes away. But Eretz Yisrael wasn't distributed until they entered into the land of Israel, or later on at the end of the time of the Midbar, Chefer is not alive at that time. So how can you claim that Tzlafchad should be entitled to a double portion in Chefer's property if when Chefer passed away, he still didn't have possession of Eretz Yisrael? That means that he's not Mukhuzak in it. It's Ra'oi. It's something that will in the future be bequeathed to him. But at this moment, it's not in his possession. So why was Tzlafchad entitled to a double portion in that possession of Chefer? Samar Yehuda HaMishmol, B'yatei Dot O'alim. They were speaking about the spikes or the pegs for holding up the tents. The way that Rashbam explains it is that that's an example of something that is metaltalin. Whereas the Rashba quotes the Rabbeinu Chananel, who suggests that it teaches another din, that yitedot olim, the tent pegs are considered or classified as metaltalim, even though they are pounded into the ground or submerged in the ground, they don't have a din of karka, but a din of metaltalin. So when they're talking about a double portion, they're not talking about a double portion in the land of Israel or in the karka. They were simply saying that any possessions or metaltalin that he had, that the Bechor should have a right to a double portion. And the quintessential example of metaltalin in the Midbar would be the staves or the tent pegs that you had, because anybody who lived in the Midbar obviously lived in a tent. So given that, they are speaking here not about property rights, they're speaking about rights to the assets of Chefer, that they should get a double portion through their father Tzlafchad, but not a claim on Eretz Yisrael. So, Meitiv Rabbo, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Benot Tzlafchad Natnu Dalet Chalakim. Then we already see that Rabbi Yehuda suggested that Benot Tzlafchad took four portions in Eretz Yisrael. Shenemar vayiplu chavlei mashenei asara. You saw on yesterday's daf, it says in Yoshua that Menashe got 10 portions. And over there, the Gemara enumerated that 6 of those portions were for the 6 different batei avot. And the additional 4 portions belonged to the benot Tzlafchad. So benot Tzlafchad added in 4 portions. But those 4 portions that they got were constituted of Tzlafchad's piece of the land, the double portion that he got from his father Hefer, as well as an additional portion that he got from one of his deceased brothers. So those are 4 portions, but part of that is the fact that he had inherited as a Bechor. So you see that this idea of the Bechor is not just about the assets of Hefer, it's literally about the land that he inherited. So Amar Rabbo, so this is something we've already said before, but obviously we knew it because of what the Gemara concluded over here. Eretz Yisrael mukuzeket hi. That when it came to the distribution of the land of Israel, it belonged to those parties to whom it was distributed. The Yotzei Mitzrayim, who are the inheritors of the land, they not only are entitled to the land, they are actually mukzak in the land. It's as if it was given to them already. It's as if it's in their possession. And again, 2 daf ago, we already learned that from the pasuk of Natati Otalachem Morasha, because it's Hashem says that I'm going to give it to you as an inheritance, and that is Moshe Rabbeinu in beginning of Parshat Ve'era, speaking to the Yotzei Mitzrayim. And the Yotzei Mitzrayim, he's promising them that they are going to be entitled, they are going to be the Morishim of the land. And since it, now you're Mukhzak in it, then the Bechor can actually inherit the double portion in it. Now, that either could be because of what we just said, because, as the Rashbam points out, the Pasuk that we used before, or it might be that the difference between Ra'ui and Mukhzak is, Ra'ui is something that in the future you will be entitled to. So if in the future the other person passes away, this asset will pass to you. In that, the Bechor doesn't get a double portion because there's no guarantees that that actual property will end up with the Bechor. And therefore, it's not considered as if the person who is the rightful inheritor to this inheritance has gotten it already. Since it's something in the future, on the come, that's not something that's considered as if he's in possession of it. It's only later on when it passes to this individual, while he's already in the grave, he's passed away already, then we know for certain it's going to pass down. And the difference between that, in our case over here, is who's making the promise, or who is the one that's saying that or declaring it will be the case. In the case of human beings, there's never a guarantee. The person could use up all their assets, they could distribute their assets, they could gift their assets. There's no guarantee that what you're seeing now is going to eventually end up in the possession of this inheritor. On the other hand, in our unique circumstance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the bequeather of this inheritance. He's the one guaranteeing or giving the land of Israel to these individuals. And in the case of when HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a promise, or you have a Navi that gives a prediction, then we know for certain that it's going to happen. And that's why it's considered to be Mukhzak over here, is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu guaranteed that the property is going to these individuals. So that's why we classified as if Hefer got it already. Not because of the Pasuk of Morasha, but because of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one making the promise. And because he made the promise, we look at it as if it's done or a given, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to relent or quote-unquote spend the assets or gift away the assets because it belongs to these individuals as Hashem had promised. Or the fact that it was already promised to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that by definition makes it that these individuals are Mukzakim in the property, because it's coming to them as the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So for that reason, it's considered to be that they are Mukzeket in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, the Bechor gets a double portion in the land. Meitavei, Amar Rabbi Chidka, Shimon HaShikmoni, Hayali Chaver Mitamidei Rabbi Kiva. Rabbi Chidka says, I had a partner, a peer, who was also one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva along with me. V'kach haya Rabbi Shimon HaShikmoni Omer. And this is what he used to say. Yodea haya Moshe Rabbeinu, Shebenot Tzlafchad Yoshotein. Yoshe Rabbeinu knew the halacha that the Benot Tzlafchad were entitled to Yerusha. Avaloye Yodea im notlot chelek bechora im lav. His uncertainty was whether they were entitled to a double portion, or were they not entitled to a double portion. Veruya haita parshat nachalot likateva yidei Moshe. And it would have been appropriate that the parshia of Nachalot that's found in Parshat Pinchas be said over in the name of Moshe. Ela shezachu benot Tzlafchad v'nichtava yadan. But benot Tzlafchad merited to the fact that they was written in their name or in their zchut because of the fact that they posed the question. They brought the issue to the forefront and therefore was written in their name. V'yodea ya Moshe Rabbeinu shemekoshesh b'mita. And Moshe Rabbeinu knew the fact that the mekoshesh etzim in the midbar was deserving of the death penalty. Because it says, by Shabbat, michaleha motumat. The one who violates, profanes the Shabbat will be subject to the death penalty. Aval lo yadeya be'ezo mitahu yamut. But he didn't know which death penalty he should be given. Even though whenever the Torah says mita, without any definition as to what the mita is, we assume it's mitat chenek, which is then the lowest of the death penalties that is executed by Beit Din. And so the stam, or the default assumption when you have mita, is chenek. So then why did Moshe Rabbeinu have any safek? The Torah never defined otherwise what the punishment for Shabbat is. And therefore, if he just had mechalalei mot yumat, he should have just assumed that it was chenek. So the Balei HaTosafot mentioned over here, Yesh lomar d'misvora haya nira lo shidon b'skila, that it was illogical to come to the conclusion that for Shabbat, the punishment should be skila, kav oved avodah zarah, because you know there's an equation or equivalence drawn between a mechalel Shabbat and a oved avodah zarah. And oved avodah zarah is b'skila. So maybe Shabbat should also be b'skila. We have many places in Shas where there is a comparison drawn between avodah zarah and Shabbat, and that's what compels Moshe Rabbeinu to think possibly that there should be a different outcome or a different punishment over here. Or the fact that Shabbat, it is one of the fundamental tenets of the faith. Therefore, just like avodah zarah, it should be on a different level. And then for the mitah should not be your stam or default mitah that is mentioned in the Torah. There are other ways that the Rishonim say that Moshe might have had this safek because maybe it should be something to do with Kedusha. We find other punishments by Kedusha, Mita de Shamayim or Karet. So maybe they should be associated with the Korbanot and the Kodoshim. So there are reasons to believe that maybe the Mita should be different. And therefore Moshe puts him away, Kilo Farash Ma Yaselo. They didn't know what to do with him. And therefore they had to query a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Tosva goes on to note that this might be like the Rabbonon in Sanhedrin, who suggests that when you give Hatra'ah, a warning about someone who violates a capital crime, that you don't have to tell them the exact death penalty that they're going to face. You simply have to indicate to them that they will face a death penalty for it, because otherwise, how could you have Hatra'ah for the Mekosheish Etzim if they didn't know which death penalty he was going to be given? On the other hand, he makes a suggestion that maybe even according to Rabbi Yehuda, that says you need to specifically enumerate the type of death penalty that they will face, that is only in a case where it was known. In a case where it's unknown, then it's a horat sha'ah, and all they could do is what they know. They know there's going to be a death penalty, and therefore it won't be considered a failure in the hatra'ah that is being given. So what does that teach you? And again, the parsha of Mekosheish Etzim should have been written on Yedei Moshe. Elish nitchayev Mekosheish v'nichtava yado. But the Mekosheish Etzim was culpable, and therefore, the whole parshiyah was written under his name, or the story is associated with him. L'lameitcha, to teach you, shemigalgalim zuchut ayadei zakai, v'chuva ayadei chayav. To teach you that we associate a merit with those that are meritorious, and we associate a demerit with those that are obligated. In essence, the b'not tzavcha that merit share in the chelik in the Torah because of coming forth and explaining why they should be the rightful heirs to their father, tzavchad, they were given the merit of the parshia being written in their name. And similarly, the Mekosheish Etzim, who went ahead and did something that was chayav, that obligated him the death penalty. And the chuvah here, the negative aspect of the Mekosheish Etzim is not only that he has a death penalty and it's something negative, as the Rashbam points out, it is the worst or the most severe of the death penalties, which is skila. And therefore, megalgalim chuvah yedei chayav. Then the parshiyah associated with the most severe death penalty is associated with him in particular, rather than Moshe Rabbeinu. What the Gemara over here is doing is in some senses dealing with a theological problem or a huge problem in the Torah, which is that we find parshiyot, not only just the Mekosheish Etzim and not only the Benot Tzlafchad, it's true by Pesach Sheni, it's true by the Megadeif, which is that in Sefer Bamidbar we find halachot that we haven't seen before. We find halachot in Vayikra and in Bamidbar that we don't find that were given in Sinai and that are not mentioned anywhere else. And they're specifically associated with the stories or the events that took place. But that would lead one to believe that it was only precipitated by the event that this halacha came about. Pesach Sheni comes because the people complain that they are Tmeim the Nefesh Adam, and they want to bring the Korban of Pesach, and all of a sudden we have a parshia of Pesach Sheni. Similar over here, Benot Tzavchad speak up and say, what's going to happen? We're daughters, and we're only daughters. What's going to happen to us? All of a sudden, we get the parshia of Nachalot. And similarly, with regards to the Mekosheish Etzim, seems only because he violated the Shabbat, all of a sudden we get the halacha about skila. Had it not been for that, we wouldn't have known these halachot. So that runs a huge issue, which is, isn't everything Torah Mitzrayim? Didn't Moshe Rabbeinu receive all of these items Mitzrayim? So how could it be that suddenly one of these parshiot is teaching us a new halacha, or something that we didn't know before? The Rashbam himself notes the problem here. If you say, lo tomar, don't say, im lo dibru benot slavchad, lo nitchayev mekoshesh, ayu shtei parshiot chaserim in a Torah. Don't say, if the benot slavchad never spoke up, or the mekoshesh, it seemed, never took place, that they wouldn't have, these two parshiot would have been not there. We wouldn't have known these halachot. V'achinami ikalameimar sh'arbei mitzvot chaserim in a Torah, lefish lo yiru ha-masim. So now you're going to say there are many other halachot that we don't know because these events didn't take place, these incidents didn't take place. You can say that so much is missing from the Torah. So it's a dangerous path to take to say that these stories brought to light these mitzvot, and that's the only reason we have them. Then what happens if there were other incidents that took place? We'd have different Torah then? So it can't be, or the fact that it only came out or came to light because of these incidents can't be the reason that these halachot are there. The halachot have to exist because they are objectively halachot that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu or a part of the Torah, and that the incidents only help us to understand them better, or they are written by the incidents because of their relevance to them, but not because they are the precipitators of the halacha itself. So the answer to that question is being presented here by Shimon HaShikmoni, which is that it's not that these halachot were not known to Moshe Rabbeinu. It might have been that there was a detail that was unclear to Moshe Rabbeinu about the halachot, but he already had all of these halachot. So why are they written by the stories? That's the Gemara's answer, which is lalameitcha that galgalim zchut ayidei zakai vechuva ayidei chayav. That we put together, we associate a positive aspect with people who bring about a positive outcome. We associate negative outcomes with people who bring about those negative outcomes. So it's not that this wasn't Torah Mitzrayim. This is not that it was something that was put into place later, only a response to an event that took place. These are halachot that are eternal, that are part of Torah Mitzrayim. It's just that the Torah puts them together with events, first of all, to accentuate and to make it easy to understand what the punishment or what the halachot revolve around, but also to show you this concept of that we associate people with the actions that they take. So that's how Shimon HaShikmoni deals with this issue of halachot appearing in the middle of Bamidbar, halachot appearing in the middle of Sefer Vayikra. It happens to be that in this week's Parsha, the beginning of Parshat Bahar, there's a massive Ramban ala Torah that actually discusses this issue and discusses his difference in opinion with regards to Rashi as to what is considered to be Torah Mitzrayim. And the Ramban is grappling with this issue. He speaks about it in the beginning of Parshat Bahar, speaks about it in his introduction to Bamidbar as well. His belief that the Shechina Sheshara al Har Sinai, which is the famous Ramban ala Torah in Parshat Truma, moves to the Mishkan. And therefore, the halachot that are given in the Mishkan are a continuation of those halachot that were presented already Behar Sinai. And that's how the Ramban deals with the issue. Rashi, on the other hand, brings the Midrash Chazal, the beginning of Parshat Bahar, that says everything was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, and some of it was only spelled out or given, laid out to us later on in the Torah. The problem from the Ramban's explanation is that we find halachot in Sefer Dvarim that are not mentioned in Vayikra and Bamidbar. And for Ramban, that's going to be problematic, because how can you all of a sudden have a halacha that's mentioned in Dvarim that makes no appearance before? According to Ramban, in order to be classified as Torah Mitzrayim, it has to be mentioned either by Har Sinai, or it needs to be mentioned in Vayikra Ol Moed. How can you have all of a sudden a halacha in Dvarim? And that is a difficulty for the Ramban's explanation. Rashi's explanation is simply that everything was given at Sinai, and it's just distributed in other places. Again, for Rashi, it's a little difficult as to why certain halachot are placed. Some of them make sense because they're associated with the story, and therefore they put the halachot again with the story. But other halachot that seem to appear, why are they uniquely situated in these places? In each case, you have to explain it according to Rashi, why the Torah waited to put them over here, even though they were given at Har Sinai. So Rav Shimon HaShikmoni is dealing with this issue and telling us that the reason that these stories are written over here is because of their association with these particular individuals, even though Moshe Rabbeinu already knew these halachot. It's clear that he didn't know everything. He had a safek about certain issues that he needed to clarify. But the basic rules or the basic halachot were already given, and Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of those issues. The reason that the Gemara only brings two examples here, one of Benot Slavchad and one of the Mekoshei Shetzim, is based on the fact that we're going to have an opinion coming up that says that the Mekoshei Shetzim was Slavchad. That was his sin. was that he was the Mekoshei Shetzim. So that's why the Gemara brings those two examples, because they're specifically associated with the Benot Safchad. Even though, as we mentioned, there are other examples, like the example of the Megadeif, and the example of an example of Pesach Sheni, which are other examples of this phenomenon. Gemara only chose these two because of their association with the Benot Safchad. Gemara brings this because of the question that now arises from this. The Gemara says, "V'isak adat chol Eretz Yisrael mukzeket." If you believe that Eretz Yisrael is already in the possession of those individuals, "Maka mistafkole." What does Moshe Rabbeinu have a safek about? Meaning that if it's mukzeket, then it should be obvious to Moshe Rabbeinu that they get a double portion like a bechor. You just said to us, "Oh, it's clear that it's mukzeket." So if it's clear that it's mukzeket, then the Bechor gets a double portion. So then, why Mistapkale? What did Moshe have any doubt about? He gufa ka Mistapkale. That's what Gemara says. That's exactly what he was a safek about. Tichtiv. The pasuk says, V'natati ota lechem morasha ni Hashem. It says that I will give it to you as a morasha. Now, the word morasha is an ambiguous word. It's not clear whether the word morasha means a yirusha, which means something that you inherit, or morasha is something that you are morish, something that you bequeath to others. So it's hard to understand that word. It's not only in this instance by the case of Eretz Yisrael, it's also found at the end of the Torah when we have the Pasuk, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, Morasha Kilat Yaakov. So there, Morasha Kilat Yaakov, what does the Morasha mean over there? And here the Gemara tells you that they have an issue about how to translate this word, what the meaning of the word is. Does it mean Morasha Ni Yerushahi Lachem Avodichem? Does it mean that it is a Yerusha, an inheritance from your forefathers? Or maybe it means that you are bequeathers, but you're not inheritors. The way that the Rashbam reads the Safek over here is it that it is literally a Yerusha Hilachem, that you are possessors of the property, and then you will bequeath it to your children and then your grandchildren, so that you actually took possession of it, Yerusha, meaning that you are an inheritor of the property. And then when you pass it to others, you already mukhzak in it and you pass it to others. Or is the Torah saying that it's a morasha? You simply have the right of bequeathal, but you don't actually take possession of it. So in that case, then you were never really mukhzak in the property. You were simply granted a right to the next generation, but you didn't necessarily have possession of that property. You simply passed a right that was given to you, and you're going to give that right to your children. So whereas the Rashbam sees this as either Morasha, that they are the rightful heirs and inheritors of the property, and thereby taking possession of it, the Bechor then would take a double portion in it. On the other hand, if it's a Morasha, that the Morish, they only bequeath it but doesn't take possession of it, then the Bechor is not going to be entitled to a double portion over here because they were not Mukzakim in the land. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, that you are the rightful heirs. You're the one who are going to take possession of the property, and not to your children. And you will take a double portion, but your children will not take a double portion in the land, because you become the rightful heirs of the property, not your children. Maybe this is what it means. You grant the right, you are the bequeathers of the property to your children, and therefore they're entitled to a double portion. You do not get any rights in the property. You're not the mukzakim in the property, because you are going to die in the midbar. The Rabbeinu Gershom sees it being just the opposite. If it's a Yerusha for you, that means that you are the heirs of the property, and therefore the other parties are not going to get a double portion in it because you are the inheritors of the land. On the other hand, if you are Morishim, you are bequeathers of the land, then they are the rightful heirs to the land. And if they are the rightful heirs of the land, they're going to get a double portion in the land. That was a safek Moshe Rabbeinu had. He did not know which way to translate the word Morasha in this instance. And then they came to the conclusion, Pashtule Tarvayu, that the response or the answer is that both translations are true. Yerushalachem Avotechem. It is a Yerusha from your forefathers. Umorishim vein yorshim. But you will bequeath it and not inherit it. How does that work? It'll be Yerusha lechem yavotechem, which is that you are mukhzakim. You are considered to be the possessors of the land. On the other hand, there is a predictive nature here that you will bequeath the land and not inherit it yourself. That's because you're going to die in the midbar. Since you're going to die in the midbar, you will not be the physical inheritors of the land. You will only be the bequeathers of the land. So the answer to Moshe Rabbeinu is that the word Morasha, you had a safek as to which meaning is the word Morasha over here. The answer is it's both meanings. It both means that you are inheritors of the land through your forefathers, meaning coming to you from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you are the inheritors of the land, and you are the rightful heirs to the land, and therefore you're considered to be muhzakim in the land. On the other hand, you're not going to make it to the land of Israel, and there is a prophetic side to this, that they will be morishin, that they will be bequeathers of the land, and not the inheritors of the land, because they're going to pass it to their children, and not actually get it themselves. So that's how the Gemara says over here, that it has actually both aspects to it. And then the Gemara says, V'hainu dichtiv, and we have a similar phenomenon by Yaz Yashir. By Yaz Yashir, it says, Tivi'emu v'titeemu b'har nachlatcha. So the Pasuk uses the term Tivi'emu. Tivi'enu lo nemar. It doesn't say Tivi'enu, which would mean Tavi otanu, you're going to bring us, Ela Tivi'emu, which is Tivi otam, you will bring them. So why would they say that in Yaz Yashir? They had to say, bring us, they're expecting to go into Eretz Yisrael. That they had prophecy, but they didn't even know what they were prophesying. They had this inspiration in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they used a terminology that excluded themselves from being the ones that will be brought into the land. And same you saying to the Enu that you will bring us into the land, it says you will bring them into the land. And so they spoke without even knowing what they were saying, that in essence they were not themselves going to make it into the land, it would only be their children that are going into the land. And same thing is the meaning of the word Moresha, when Hashem quits Eretz Yisrael to Bnei Yisrael, it has both aspects of it. It has an aspect that you are Mukzakim in the land, but also an aspect of prophetic vision, that you are not going to be the ones who literally are there to inherit the land, you will have to bequeath it to your children, who will be the rightful heirs of the land. Alright, now the pasuk continues by Benot Tzavchad, it says, V'tamodu nifnei Moshe, v'lifnei Lazar HaKohen, Lifnei Nisim v'cholei Da. So here it has a list of individuals before whom the Bnei Tzlofchad appeared. Efshar amdu lifnei Moshe v'cholei, v'lo amru lehem davar, v'amdu lifnei Nisim v'cholei Da. The Gemara looks at the Pasuk and says, if you take the Pasuk literally, that they went before Moshe, and then they went before Lazar Kohen, and then they went before the Nisim in a sequential manner. How could it be that they went to Moshe, and Moshe doesn't know the Halacha, then they go to the next people, they go to Lazar Kohen, and then they go to the Nisim? How is it possible that the individuals, Elazar, the Nisi'im, would know something that Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't know? They all learned their Torah directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, so there's no way they're going to know anything that Moshe doesn't know. So if they got a negative answer, or they didn't get the information from Moshe, what would be the point of going down to Elazar and the Nisi'im? So the first answer of the Gemara is, Elasaresa mikra b'darsheyu divir abashaya. Yeshaya says, you should move around the Pasuk, and in essence, reverse the order of the Pasuk. It doesn't mean they went to Moshe first. It means they went to the Edah first. And then they went to the Nisim. Then they went to Lazar Kohen, and then they went to Moshe. Now, that's a nice answer, but then why did the Pasuk write in the opposite order? The reason for that is because it gave it in the hierarchy of the individuals. In order to attain Kavod to Moshe, it writes Moshe first in the Pasuk, even though that's not the order in which they presented the question. They presented the question to the lowest, and then it moved up the line until it reached Moshe Rabbeinu. All the people that they queried are mentioned in the Pasuk, but they're mentioned in a reverse order in order to give kavod to the person who is the ultimate source of all Torah, which is Moshe Rabbeinu. So he's mentioned first, even though he was the last one that they inquired of as to what the halacha is. Abba Hanan Amar, Mishum Rabbi Eliezer, Bebeit Midrash HaYoshvim, V'achuv Amdu Lifnei Kulan. They're all learning in the Beit Midrash. Moshe Rabbeinu is giving shir, or he's learning with Elazar, the Nisi'im, and the Edah. And then the Bnei Tzlofchad appear there before all of these individuals to ask their question. They presented the question, and everybody was present at the time, and that's what the Pasuk's telling you, that everybody's there. But Maika Miflegei, what are they arguing about? Masavar Chulkim Kavod Tamid B'Makom Arav. One of them says that you give Kavod to the Tamid, even when his Rebbe is present. Masavar Ein Chukim, and the other one says you do not do it. Is it appropriate when the Rebbe of the individual is there to distinguish or delineate his Talmid separately? You could look at that in one of two ways. Is that considered to be a pgia? It's an affront to the Rav that you're going to his Talmid and you're giving kavod to his Talmid and speaking to his Talmid? Is that considered to be a pgia in his kavod? Or do we see that as being an enhancement of his kavod? Because in one way, you could look at it as if you are bypassing the Rebbe and going to the Talmid, or giving the Talmid's kavod, in some ways, is to the exclusion of his Rebbe, and therefore it's an affront. Or do you say that this is the Talmid of the Rebbe, and you have, in a sense, a transitive property of kavod. If you're giving kavod to the Talmid, then certainly you're, in essence, giving kavod to the Rav, because the Rav taught this Talmid. There are two possible ways to view it, and that is the machloket over here. The question is, do you give kavod to individuals who are Talmidim? So according to the one who says that they were all present together, then when it mentions over here all the individuals, that's giving kavod to Talmid b'makom Rav. That's giving kavod to the people who are Moshe's underlings or Moshe's students in the face of Moshe. So that opinion believes that it's okay to give kavod to the Talmidim when the Rav is present, and therefore to present to all of them at once, but delineate or enumerate all of them, that is perfectly fine. And that's why he presents the situation in that manner. On the other hand, the opinion who believes that you cannot give a kavod to Talmid in front of the Rav believes that they did it sequentially, because otherwise it would be inappropriate to mention the Talmidim when you were addressing the Rav. And so therefore, he has to say, Saresa mikra v'darshehu, they reverse the pasuk and say that they went sequentially to each one of the individuals from lowest to highest. So now the Gemara says, v'hilchata chukim, v'hilchata ein chukim. The halacha is that you are cholek the Talmid b'makom Rav, and the halacha is ein chukim. The Gemara says, kasha hilchata, hilchata. How can you paskin like both opinions? It says, ahilchata, ahilchata lo kasha. That's not a problem. Had the poligle rabbe yakro? Had the lo poligle rabbe yakro? Depends on how his Rebbe treats the Talmid. If the Rebbe gives kavod to the Talmid, that means that he also has a certain amount of respect for the Talmid, and he's proud of his student's accomplishments. And given that he's proud of his student's accomplishments, if you were to give kavod to the Talmid, that would also be a kavod the Rav, because he would bask in that glory or the kavod that you're affording his Talmid because of the way that he treats his Talmid. On the other hand, if it's a Talmid where the Rebbe does not give kavod to the Talmid, he still doesn't view him as being, we'll call it maybe a Talmid chaver, or he still doesn't view him as being someone of stature that's deserving of individual kavod, then if the Rebbe is not affording him kavod, so too the public at large should not be affording him kavod in front of his Rebbe. Because then it is an affront to his Rebbe. His Rebbe doesn't think he's ready yet, or doesn't think he's on the level of receiving kavod, then you should go ahead and then in front of the Rebbe give kavod to the Talmid. That would be inappropriate. And so, over here, that's the question. What's Moshe Rabbeinu's relationship with these other parties? Does he view them as being Talmidim, and that's it, solely Talmidim? Or does he put them up on a pedestal where he also affords kavod to them? And the truth is that the Pasuk in the Torah seems to indicate that Moshe Rabbeinu does have a certain amount of deference towards the people that are mentioned here, which is that, as Moshe Rabbeinu in the Parsha of Eldad Medad says, Umi Yitein Kol Am Hashem Nevi'im, where he says that, well, I wish that Hashem would make all the people into Nevi'im, and therefore you see Moshe giving deference to the Eidah, or to Klal Yisrael as a whole, and therefore when Benot Tzavcha did it, it wasn't offensive to him because he was Cholei Kavod to them. Obviously, the other opinion believes that ein chokim kavod haTalmid b'makom Rav, and therefore they did it in a sequential order and not altogether. Now the Gemara continues. Benot Tzavchad hachmaniyotein, they were wise. Darshaniyotein, they knew how to make drashot. Tzidkaniyotein, they were righteous. So now the Gemara goes through each one of these. Hachmaniyotein, what does it mean that they were wise? Shlefisha'a dibru, they knew how to pick their spot. So the way that the Rashbam says hachmaniyotein is that they were hachmaniyot b'derech eretz. They understood the way of the world, or they understood how to properly present a question, or the timing of their presentation. Which is, according to the Gemara here, Damar Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak Mameid, Shaya Moshe Rabbeinu Yoshev v'doresh b'parshat Yivamim. Moshe Rabbeinu was sitting there and doresh at Parshat Yivamim, Shneamar, because the Pasuk says, by Parshat Yibum, Ki Yeshvu Achim Yachdav, that when two brothers live at the same time, and then it says, if there is no child, then there's a requirement for the brother to marry the wife or the widow in order to produce a child that will be named after the brother who was deceased. Amrulo, im keben anu, chashuvim, if we're considered to be like a son, tnarula nachala keben, give us an inheritance like a son. Im lav, if not, titiabe mimenu, then our mother should be subject to yibum. Miyad vayakrev Moshe mishpatam lifnei Hashem. Then Moshe presents their mishpat before Hashem. So they were chokhmaniyotein because of their presentation of the question at the right moment. They brought their question to light while Moshe Rabbeinu is teaching about Parshat Yibum, because they're able to use Parshat Yibum as a platform or a springboard for their question. So they waited for that opportune moment to present their question while Moshe Rabbeinu was darshaning about Parshat Yibum, and saying in Parshat Yibum that not only is a male son good enough to obviate the need for Yibum, any offspring, Ayin Alav, look at any offspring, every offspring will block the need for Yibum. Now, if you think about how Yibum works, we said before that Yibum is what establishes the hierarchy of individuals in terms of Yerusha. So we said before that why does the ben, the son, get Yerusha before the brothers of the deceased? Because Yibum shows that the brothers of the deceased could step into the shoes of the deceased. The answer was that the son is a blocking element there. If there is a son, the brothers do not step into the shoes of their deceased brother. That shows you that the son then becomes the rightful heir to that individual. And so what Benot Slavchad are saying, if the son is who blocks Yibum, and therefore he's the rightful heir to the deceased, then if in our situation as daughters, if we don't block the need for Yibum, then our mother is Chayevet in Yibum. If you're saying that Ben in the Parsha of Yibum doesn't literally mean a son, but means children, because it says, Ben ain't low, we darshin, I ain't allowed to check out and engage in an investigation to see if he has any offspring, and then any offspring that he has would then block the need for Yibum, that shows you that whoever that offspring is the rightful heir to the deceased. So over here, if you're going to say that we as daughters make it that our mother does not need to have Yibum performed with her, that shows you that we are then the rightful heirs to this property. And that was the thought process that they had in approaching Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why they waited for that opportune moment. That sometimes it's not the brilliance of the question. It isn't even the question itself. It's the timing of the question that makes all the difference. And they knew that. And so they brought their question to light in a situation in which it was favorable to the outcome, or they had good evidence of the outcome that they would expect in that case. V'darshani otem, that they were those that were doresh, sheyom rot, ilu hayalo ben lo dibarnu. Because it says in the Torah that they recognized or understood that if there was a child or if there was a son, that they wouldn't be presenting their case before Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, lama yigara shem avinu mitoch mishpachto. Why should our father's name be wiped out of his family? Ki ein lo ben, because he has no son. Tlanu az chuzah betoch achei avinu. Let us take a portion amongst our uncles, our father's brothers. So what you see here is that they recognize Ke'en Lo Ben, that he didn't have a son. Had he had a son, they wouldn't have presented their question. So they were darshani otem, they were able to be doresh, or understood clearly that if there was a son there, then they would have been precluded from the Yerusha. So they understood that point, and they bring that issue to the forefront saying, there is no son. And since there is no son, we should be entitled to inheritance over here. The question is, how did they know that? Or what type of drasha were they making over here? So the Rishbam suggests that it comes out of the Parshia of Nachalot, where it says in the beginning of the Parshia of Nachalot, it says, Ish ki amutu ben eno, varvartem en nachloto lubito. So you see there that Ben has to come before the Bat. And they understood that when it says Ben and then varvartem nachloto lubito, it doesn't mean, like Rapapa said earlier in the Perek, that they should then equally share in the Yerusha, but they understood that meant that the Ben got precedence over the Bat. The Balei at Tosafot are perplexed by that, because Vekasha, Dakati lo amra. What are you talking about? The Parshia of Nachalot was yet to be given. I mean, the Parshia of Nachalot comes right after they make their point. So how could it be that they were relying on the Parshia of Nachalot to make their point, if it has yet to be given? It's only given after they present their question to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You could learn like Shimon HaShikmoni, which is that the Parshia was already given to Moshe Rabbeinu back in Parshat Mishpatim, where Sham Sam Lo Choku Mishpat V'Sham Nisau. The Parshiot of Dinim and civil laws and all these issues already presented to Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's how they knew about it. That's what you'd have to answer on behalf of the Rishbam. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot make a number of suggestions as to how they came about that drasha. They bring from the Rishba, from the Rosh Mishantz, Ayu Yodot, Mivenehit Nachaltem, Livnechem Achareichem. It comes to, at the end of Parshat Behar, when it speaks about the Eved Kanani, that he is considered to be property, it says over there that you pass that property, you pass that Eved Kanani, Livnechem, to your sons. And they knew the drasha of Livnechem, Velo Livnotechem. That's one possibility of what they were Doresh. The other possibility is, Inami Misvora. It was a logical argument. Mishum Debat, Misebat Nechala, that a daughter is going to cause the transference of Yerusha from Shevet to Shevet. So they knew that it made more sense for the sons to inherit than the daughters to inherit, and that was their logical argument. Either because they knew that it followed the Beit Avutam, this week's Parsha, Parsha Bin Midbar, when they count the individuals, they count on the Mishpachutam, the Beit Avutam. So the father is the Yichus of the father. So that information was already disclosed to them. So they knew that if a daughter took possession of the property, it would cause it to move from Shevet to Shevet. That's how they made that argument. Or they learned it out as Inami, Mirchtiv Le'ela Techaleka Daritz. It says in Parshat Pinchas, after the census, to these individuals, you're going to distribute the land. And the only people enumerated in the census are the males over the age of 20. So that's the way that, according to the Baalei Tosafot, they knew that the son would take precedence and the daughter afterwards. That's what the Gemara says over here, that they were Darshaniotim, that they were able to be Doresh. They were able to understand intuitively what the halacha would derive from these other Parshiot. And therefore, when they make their presentation, they make the presentation assuming that a son would have gotten precedence. And they're making it clear that there is no son here. That's why they're making their claim. So now they say, V'atanya bat. We have a braita that says bat in it, a daughter in it. We have a braita that says, Ilai lo bat lo dibarnu. So, Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah sami mikan bat. Just get rid of that braita. It makes no sense. As the Rashbam points out, even the questioner didn't know what to do with this braita. He's just presenting the braita and saying that if you're explaining it this way, how are you going to explain this other braita? But not that he himself had a way to explain it or he had a way to deal with it. So Rabbi Yirmiyah says that it's a problematic braita. Just get this braita out of here because it doesn't make any sense. Bayamara filo aya bat leben lo dibarnu. That rather, it doesn't mean bat means a daughter, but bat means bat aben. Even if there was a granddaughter, we wouldn't have come and made a claim. We're only making a claim because there is no son, and there is no daughter to the son. We understand that if our niece was alive now, that we would have no rights. Had our father had a son, and then his son had a daughter, that niece of ours would have taken precedence over us. And that's what they knew, and that's what the Braita says, V'atanya bat. The Baalei Tosafot are bothered by that, because they say, how would they have known that? How do they have any idea that a niece would take precedence over daughters? That's something called mishmush, which we say is that it passes through the kever. Now, if someone has passed away, they still maintain their rights of inheritance and precedence in rights of inheritance. That's not something that you could easily darish from the psukim. You need a specific mesorah about that. So how is it possible, if you're going to explain the brayta that way, that the Bnot Slavchad knew about that? He says, maybe you could have learned it out of Parshat Yevamin. Because with the Parshat of Yevamah, a granddaughter is as successful as a daughter in blocking the need for Yibum. So you see from there that a granddaughter is considered to be stepping into the shoes of the deceased, or considered to be an offspring of the deceased, even though they're a granddaughter. And so through Parshat Yevamim, they might have been able to intuit that that was the halacha, and therefore the other braita could be explained that that's where they were Dereshoni Yotem. They were able to come to these conclusions from looking at those Parshiot. Tzidkani Yotem, they were righteous individuals. Shinonisu Elalagon Nahem, that they only married those that were appropriate for them. Which means that Moshe Rabbeinu offers them the alternative as to what they want to do. They have two choices. And that is because in the Parshia, that this, when the Bnei Yosef come and complain about the fact that they're going to lose Nachalah from their Shevet if you give the property to Bnot Zlevchad, Moshe Rabbeinu says, Zeh Adavar Shetziva Hashem Li Bnot Zlevchad Emor, L'tov Be'enehem Tiena L'Nashim. You can marry whoever you want. Ach, L'mishpachat Matei Aviyem Tiena L'Nashim. But you should only marry someone within your father's family. V'lo Tisov Nachalad V'Nisrael Mi Matei Al-Matei. And in that way, the property will not move from Shevet to Shevet. Ki'ish b'nachalat matei avotav yidbeku b'nei Yisrael. You should marry within your own Shevet. And in marrying in your own Shevet, you will ensure that the property doesn't pass from one Shevet to the other Shevet. And so that's what the Rashbam explains over here, that Moshe Rabbeinu gave them good advice. He's basically saying to them, you can marry whoever you want. You have a choice. It's up to you to marry whichever individual you think is appropriate for you. But I'm going to give you good advice. You probably should marry someone within your Shevet, because if you marry someone within the Shevet, you'll find someone who is appropriate or the right person for you. And that's what the Rishbam says. Elamani mikayim mishpachat matei aviyem te'el nashim. What does Moshe Rabbeinu mean that they should marry someone within the family? Itza tova yisiyana katuv. The puzzle is giving them good advice. Shloi nasu elalagunen. They should only marry people who are appropriate for them. Alma mishpachat matei aviyem hagunim ayu. That's telling them that these people of the family are appropriate for you, and they followed that directive, and they ended up marrying Livnei Dodehem, marrying their cousins in order to facilitate staying within their Shevet. But the way that we're interpreting it now is to say that Moshe gave them the option to marry any party, but then he makes a suggestion. He says, you know, it'd be kedai for you to marry within your father's family, And Moshe Rabbeinu in saying that wasn't just advice in order to preserve the Yerusha and keep the Yerusha within the Mateh, but was also giving them advice that these are good people. These are the right people. These are the appropriate people for you. And therefore you should marry them. And they heeded Moshe's advice and they end up marrying those from their father's family. They married those that were Hagunim, those that were appropriate for them. And so you see there that they abided by Moshe's Eitza advice, and that's what made them into Tzidkaniyot. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines on the bottom of Kuf Yutet, I'm going to bet.